The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And welcome to IMC and here in person and also online. And so today is the anniversary of the delayed emancipation of African Americans here in the United States. Some two and a half years after Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. It took that long for some of the slaves in this country and slaveholders to finally realize that freedom from slavery in Texas in 1865. And it's now that it's become a national holiday, it's the United States now has two Independence Days. And the first one marks a certain kind of independence and also represents, in many ways, an independence that was only partial. Independence that ended up legalizing the enslavement of other people. So a freedom that some people attained, but which institutionalized or sanctioned the lack of freedom for others. And it took almost another 100 years before legally that freedom became much more complete in that slaves were emancipated. And as probably many of you know this, the history, but that's been celebrated every year, first in Galveston, Texas, and then it spread to Texas and to other places over time. And until now, it's a national holiday. And the people who mostly celebrated until recently have been Black Americans, who were most impacted by this. And it was certainly a celebration for them of this freedom from slavery. It was also a remembering of the horrendous oppression and suffering that their ancestors went through. And it's good to remember. And then there's, but also many African Americans have used the time as a celebration of their achievement, their perseverance, how brilliantly some of them have worked through their oppression, including the challenges they've had over the last 160, 70 years since emancipation. And it's remarkable how much African Americans have contributed to this culture, not just contributed to help make it, with some phenomenal achievements and highest levels of government and military and science and literature and music. It just goes on and on. So this day is also the celebration of this, of the tremendous drive and creativity and capacity of this population of people who've been so oppressed. And for me personally, I'm inspired very much by this perseverance, the degree to which so many of them have not given up, have not turned around to reject this country, but really have stepped up in a powerful way to claim their place as citizens of this country, proud citizens of this country, and have met with oppression violence and murder and all kinds of things. Some of them with persevering and insisting on the truth, insisting on asserting or finding their freedom. But also, many of them, maybe partly from their Christian background, but a message of forgiveness and love. It's phenomenal to see how this has worked, that someone with so much stacked against them, so much horrible things done to them, have kept showing up over and over again, and excelled in so many different ways, including in the capacity to love. I've met a number of African Americans who have been practitioners. Some of them have become Buddhist teachers, and have learned a little bit about their personal story and how challenging it's been growing up in this country and what they've had to face. But that they came to Buddhist practice in order to deal with their tremendous pain that they carried with them and their tremendous rage, their anger, and how difficult it was to sit in a room full of mostly white people in retreats and sit there. But they use this practice in order to somehow resolve that and work with it and heal it. And came out the other side with a dignity and confidence and a capacity, because they had healed their rage and their woundedness, a capacity to still be in the fire of racism in this country, but to be able to look it in the face with strength and confidence, and with a certain kind of love, sometimes a fierce love. And sometimes I met these African American practitioners and have been kind of in awe of them and kind of like, inspired by them, and kind of felt, wow, I hope, would I be able to do that? Would I have been able to manage with that level of challenge? You would hope so. But I don't know. So a day to celebrate, the amazing accomplishment of what a free people can do, and to recognize there's a plenty of people who are not yet free enough. There's still oppression in this country. There's still limitations and things that undermine lots of people, not just African Americans, but that's what we're celebrating today. And that keep lots of things that keep them from excelling, keep them from living a free life, keep them from fulfilling their capacity in beautiful ways. So what I'd like to do today is to teach you what in the teachings of the Buddha are called the four great resolves. The four things. The word resolve here, the Pali word is adhitana, which kind of etymology of the word means something like a higher stand, like where you take your stand. So it's not just a resolve, which can feel like where you're headed, a resolve to get someplace, but this is where we take our stand. Like this, this is what we're committed to and where we're going to find our way. And these four resolves or four stands are wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. So I'll say a little bit about them, but mostly what I want to do is use this as a structure to read some quotations from African-American writers, activists, people. And I've chosen different quotes that kind of fit into these categories, and that might kind of give a different application or orientation in order to kind of consider these four stands. I think many, in the context of this Buddhist meditation practice, that these four resolves are often understood in terms of our own practice. It's like turned inward towards ourselves, how to practice. And that's actually very significant to do that. And that's what these African-American practitioners in some ways did in order to find their freedom, in order to be able to go out. And afterwards, some of them are kind of activists now. So there's a place for that. But we tend to limit ourselves too much, our freedom in being internally focused sometimes in this Buddhist practice. And so to hear these quotations in the context of these four resolves might be interesting too for our reflection, and also a way of kind of honoring this holiday. So the first one, wisdom. And there's a number of definitions of wisdom in Buddhism, but the one that I find most inspiring is not that of wisdom, but of a wise person. So how a wise person thinks is their wisdom. And the Buddha says a wise person is someone who considers their own welfare, the welfare of others, the welfare of both self and others, and the welfare of the whole world. This is different than what most people think wisdom is in Buddhism, or many of the things that are defined as wisdom. Sometimes it's, you know, people point to emptiness or the Four Noble Truths or to dependent arising, all kinds of things, kind of other things. But to front and center define wisdom and have wisdom be connected to welfare. And for that, we have to know, what is welfare? What is the well-being? And we have to, for that to be concerned for the welfare of others, we have to know them. We have to know something about them. We have to be able to meet them with a lot of respect and understanding. And so to have Buddhist practice, that part of the context for it, according to the Buddha, is this mutual welfare. And when he says, the Buddha says, self, other, self and other, and the whole world. There's no explanation of what these four categories are, but self and other, I understand it to be the we, the relationship we have, what happens when we come together, the interrelatedness that we have, and that gets created in our mutual contact with each other. And then the whole world, I just take it to be, you know, our scope or the care of a wise person is 360 degrees. Nothing's left out. Nothing is outside the purview of what our care is. So one of the really one great African-American historians in this country was W.E.B. Du Bois. Amazing man who, you know, there was about a century from the time of the end of the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation, to the Civil Rights Act. And in that 100 years, he lived 95 of them. He was born in 1868, died in 1963, a year before the Civil Rights Act, which he championed and, you know, worked for. And what a lifetime to live through. Jim Crow and Ku Klux Klan and, you know, World War I and World War II and the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, just so many powerful things that happened. And he studied it, he wrote about it, he commented, he was a prolific writer and one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So he wrote, "Herein lies the tragedy of the age. Not that men are poor, all men know something of poverty. Not that men are wicked, who after all is good. Not that men are ignorant, after all, what is truth? Nay, the tragedy is that men know so little of men." A little hard to read when we don't use gender-inclusive language these days, but this was the language of the time. The tragedy of we don't know each other. And so one of his summations of all the suffering that he's seeing in his country, in this country at his time, And this quote kind of zeroes in on it. We don't know each other well enough. And what happens when we really know people? There was a African-American jazz player who made it his mission to convert or disarm members of the Ku Klux Klan. And he would go around to Ku Klux Klan rallies, and he would befriend the people there, become their friends, get in, invite them out for lunch, invite them to their houses for lunch. And these Klan people, they never had friendship with a black person. And they got to know him, and they realized that their beliefs, their vision, a view of what a black person is, was wrong. And they left the Klan. Some of the high wizards left the Klan. And he has a whole collection of Klan robes that they gave to him as kind of to mark this, they're leaving the Klan. And he collects them. He has a big, you know, closet full of them. But what a remarkable thing to do. I mean, that kind of sounds a little crazy, you know, in principle to me. But you can read about him. There's lots of articles about him. And I forget his name. Alice Walker, healing begins where the wound was made. Healing begins where the wound was made. So here also this wisdom of knowing, you know, being concerned for the welfare of others, but can you know about the welfare of others without knowing the wound they have, the suffering, the challenges they have? And one of the principles of wisdom in Buddhism is the wisdom, the importance of being attuned to suffering, being attuned to pain, the wounds, the challenges of ourselves and others, not so that we're oppressed by it or suffer even more, but without understanding our suffering, without understanding our societal suffering, there's no hope to move through it and find the freedom on the other end. Healing begins where the wound was made. James Baldwin wrote, "For while the tale of how we suffer and how we are delighted and how we may triumph is never new, it always must be heard. There isn't any other tale to tell. It's the only light we got in all this darkness." So we have the wisdom of facing this, to be able to tell the story and or to recognize how we suffer, how we're delighted, and how we triumph. And that's what, you know, this holiday is about, in part, just not only freedom, but the triumphing of those African-Americans who have really pushed through their oppression and excelled in so many different ways. And Malcolm X, man who's a little controversial perhaps for some people, but has many people have come to appreciate him more and more as the distance of his time. "We are not fighting for integration, nor are we fighting for separation. We are fighting for recognition as human beings. In fact, we are actually fighting for rights that are even greater than civil rights, and that is human rights." So, fighting for recognition. Hey, we're here. We count. We're important. There's, you know, this, I think it's a wonderful rallying cry and a teaching in its own right. The slogan, Black Lives Matter. And because there's been so much resistance to this slogan in this country, surprising that anybody would resist that slogan. I wonder sometimes whether if we add one word to it, whether that would help. Black Lives Matter also. Because who could argue against that? So wisdom, recognition, seeing the wound, recognizing other people, recognizing the humanity of others, and you know, is part of this whole wisdom tradition. So here, not just for in ourselves, but now looking outwards into this world. So the second resolve is truth. And this is central to Buddhist practice. We practice mindfulness to be able to be present for what is most true, the truth that's liberating. And for personal liberation, it's a real deep look inside, into the depths of our hearts. For societal liberation, there has to be some study and recognition of what's true out there, and avoid lies. Complicated issue in some ways, but certainly we have examples in contemporary society where it's not a question of what is true and what's lies, because it's freely admitted that people are lying, but they're doing it anyway. Tremendous cost to our society. So Nicole Hannah Jones, who's one of the main originators of the 1619 project to study racism in this country, she wrote, "If we, here in the United States, if we are truly a great nation, then the truth cannot destroy us." It's a powerful statement in my mind. So here they're trying to bring out the truth of the wound, of what's happened here, that so many people are resisting and not wanting, thinking that somehow it's going to do something terrible. But the truth can never destroy us. Dubois said, "The cure isn't simply telling people the truth. It is inducing them to act on the truth." So to act, to live the truth, to act on what's true. So, you know, part of the danger in Buddhism where we have, in our practice at least, where we're having insights and understanding and wisdom, is that they're powerful for us maybe to see the truth in some ways in our practice. But then we don't take the next step, which is to understand how that influences or inspires living a different way. Let go of attachments, not so that we can watch more Netflix and not have to worry about anything because we did our own spiritual work, but to discover how to let go of our attachments so that then we can step into the world in a free way dedicated to freedom. My sense, I'll go on. So then there comes relinquishment. Relinquishment is a fascinating word because it also, the Pali word, chaga, for relinquishment, also means generosity. And the fact that relinquishment, letting go in some deep way, can mean generosity, it kind of gives a different twist, because some people think relinquishment is kind of giving something up. But the word giving up originally, apparently, suggested offering something up on the altar. Giving, it's also the word giving is in it. And though sometimes in colloquial English, giving up feels like a kind of a hopeless surrender or something. But what if giving up is a powerful act of independence and freedom, and that it's not surrendering something, but rather stepping in, letting go to step forward in a free way. So again, Dubois, "There is in this world no force as the force of a man determined to rise. The human soul cannot be permanently chained. The human heart cannot be permanently chained." The human soul cannot be permanently chained. And for me, I translate that as heart. Our heart does not want to be held in check, doesn't want to be repressed or held down. There is in us a call to freedom, a yearning for freedom, to be set free. And I believe that once we do mindfulness practice or meditation practice, that lets the mind quiet down enough, from all its distractions, all its preoccupations, and we can feel, listen, hear ourselves more deeply, we'll hear that call for freedom. The way in Theravada Buddhism that's expressed is the word ehi pasiko, which means come and see. There's a call. There's the call to come and see. Come and look here. Freedom is found here. Come and look for it. One Buddhist saying, a Chinese Buddhist saying, is that freedom beckons us in everything. There's a call to freedom. The heart wants to be free. The heart doesn't want to suffer. And one of the simplest kind of maybe rational, maybe even mechanical ways of understanding this call to freedom is that it's a call to let go of all the ways in which the heart is contracted or tight, fisted up. And it's a lot of work to do that. It's a lot of effort. And if you really, if you feel into a fist which is all contracted and tight, you feel kind of a call in the fist to relax. It doesn't want to be that way. You have to assert the mind over and over again to keep the hand fisted up. There is a call in the heart for freedom, for release. The human soul cannot be permanently chained. Dubois again. The cost of liberty is less than the price of repression. That's a powerful statement. And I don't know if we can reword it for the cost of freedom is less than the price of attachment, the price of craving, clinging. So if you want to do the economic analysis of this practice, it clearly comes in favor of us doing the work to become free. Dubois again. I believe in liberty for all men, the space to stretch their arms and their souls, the right to breathe and the fight to vote, the freedom to choose their friends, enjoy the sunshine, and ride on the railroads, uncursed by color, thinking, dreaming, working as they will in a kingdom of beauty and love. Working as they will in a kingdom of beauty and love. Don't we want to live in a kingdom like that? A world like that? Don't we want to contribute to that? Don't we want to be someone who contributes to beauty, love, and freedom? I think that it's actually, if you learn how to do it, it's actually less work than the alternative. And then a colleague of Dubois was a man named Carter Woodson. He was actually the main founder of the NAACP. Lived around the same time. And he wrote, history shows that it does not matter who is in power or what revolutionary forces take over the government. Those who have not learned to do for themselves and have to depend solely on others never obtain any more rights or privileges in the end than they had in the beginning. So this is where Buddhist practice comes into play, because this is a kind of specialty of Buddhism, I think, that has to contribute to all this. Those who have not learned to do for themselves and have to depend solely on others. Buddhist practice is leading us to becoming independent. There's a certain kind of, the Buddha was explicit using this word, not dependent, to live a life not dependent on anything. Not dependent on others. Is that possible? Psychologically, in a certain way, it is possible. And to the degree to which the heart can become independent, without that, Woodson doesn't believe it's possible to have any other freedom. So then, in terms of this freedom, living a life of beauty, living a life of love, Toni Morrison has this beautiful quote: "If you can't imagine it, you can't have it. If you can't imagine it, you can't have it." So some of you maybe don't feel like you have freedom yet, full freedom. Don't live a life of full love in all the contexts that you'd like to live it. Maybe you even have to, but imagine that it's possible. Imagine it. Have a vision for it. The first experience of liberation in Buddhism is often called a vision. Then we have a vision of what's possible. The first experience of liberation is not the end, but it's the beginning. Because now we can imagine it. As So the four resolves: wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and now the fourth one is peace. And for the Buddha, in terms of the kind of emotional experience of liberation, what it actually feels like, he has two concepts that he presents. One is peace, and the other is happiness. Peaceful happiness, happy peace, if you put them together. So peace is kind of like one of the goals of the Buddha's practice. And Malcolm X said, "You cannot separate peace from freedom, because no one can be at peace unless he has his freedom." No one can be at peace unless he has his freedom. So we don't want to live in a world where people are denied their freedom. Dubois: "What a world this will be when human possibilities are freed, when we discover each other, when the stranger is no longer the potential criminal and the certain inferior." Doesn't really mention peace, but this is where the quote got put. The world of human possibilities. Toni Morrison: "Don't let anybody convince you this is the way the world is and therefore must be. It must be the way it ought to be." This is an unusual quote for Buddhists in our scene. It ought to be different. We keep emphasizing, you know, you have to see the world as it is. Yes, we see the world as it is so that the social world can become what it ought to be. We see the truth of what's happening, things as they are in our hearts, so that our lived life in this world can be as it's possible, as we can imagine it. If we only accept things as they are, ourselves as we are, nothing's really going to change. And is there really a freedom to be found by simply accepting things as they are? I'd say no. Things have to change. To the degree to which Buddhists practice acceptance, it's only so that we get to know them better, more deeply. Only so that our reactivity and our attachments don't get the upper hand. But not, we don't accept so that we permanently accept. We learn how to be present, to see things as they are, so that we can let this growth into freedom happen. That's what our heart wants. That's what the heart, the ought of our hearts. There is a possibility for a different life. There is a possibility for a different society. Whether or not we attain it in this lifetime, in this century, in this millennia, one of the most powerful ways of freedom gets enacted and lived is we don't limit our freedom, our enactment, by the short-term possibilities. What's important, and even by the results, what's important is we act in free ways. We act for freedom. We become someone who wants to live expressing our love, our care, maybe a certain beauty, and freedom. So we can be free, and the love in our hearts can be set free, so that we can be attuned and supportive of the freedom and love that others can have, the possibility of freedom and love between self and others, and to contribute to a world where freedom and love are recognized, appreciated, valued, and celebrated. And may it be that on this day of the Juneteenth, that's a day where we appreciate, value, and start to live more fully, dedicate ourselves to the advancement, the freedom, the happiness of everyone, including, and maybe with some priority, the African Americans in this country. They've been forgotten, ignored, oppressed for centuries. And so there's a little bit of reckoning that we should do and care for and support a real change. Continue the change that's happening in a good direction on this Juneteenth day. So thank you. Wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. So we will stop, and then if those of you who would like, we'll take some chairs, folding chairs, outside on the parking lot, and we can sit there and have a little discussion and check in and whatever happens. We can take our masks off if you like. You can keep it on if you like out there, and that's nice. You're all welcome to come. It's nice to have a chat. And one of the things I'd like to do, maybe at the beginning of that gathering, is to talk a little bit about some of the thinking about how to, what kind of changes we might enact for the COVID protocol for coming here on Sunday mornings in July. It's maybe not a lot big change, but a little bit of change. One of them is maybe to stop using this whole registration system we have, to have it be an honor system that people are vaccinated, still wear masks, but maybe also not limit the numbers and see what happens if it just, with that. We haven't decided what to do, but I thought at least to give you, those of you who'd like to stay and have some discussion about it, we could begin our conversation out there with that. So thank you very much, and